Today's episode of Opening Arguments is brought to you by Simple Contacts. And they have a special deal for our listeners. If you head on over to simplecontacts.com/OA or enter the promo code OA at checkout, you will receive $30 off. So head on over, simplecontacts.com/OA or enter the promo code OA.
You fellas want to read me my rights?
You have the right to have your face kicked in by me. You have the right to have your balls stomped by him.
I'll waive my rights.
Pretty simple. The forms are all standard boilerplate.
Okay, well, we're all hungry. We're going to get to our hot plate soon enough, all right? But let's talk about the contract here.
Sorry.
You'd be surprised how many doors a letter from a lawyer can open or close.
It seems like you're talking slower since you started charging by the hour.
What's the meaning of this? This is my quiet time.
We're gonna have to take you into custody.
That's outrageous. What am I charged with?
Don't have to tell you anymore. Clearly haven't been reading your Scalia.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. And how about that intro we just heard? It's all new. We do this joke every time because the intro is not done when we record this episode. But man, God, love all those new quotes. No, that'll be great. I hope you enjoyed them and the Lionel Hutz one and the jokes we always make. How's it going, Andrew?
It's going okay, Thomas. How are you?
Well, I hurt my back and existence is pain. But other than that, No, I'm not doing good. It's existence is pain. That's my answer. But the only thing that can make me feel better is opening arguments. So,
well, I hope it helps. I don't know that we want to get out the reputation that the show is a painkiller. But no.
Well,
it is
for
it
me. Look, I can't I say that it works for me.
There we go.
I'm actually hanging upside down right now. You know, like while recording, it's the only way. But no, I'm really excited. We're going to talk about. You know, Trump's Nobel Prize for the Korea No, we're not talking about that because that didn't happen. No, we've got some great stuff. We're talking about Avenatti. He's in the news for some interesting reasons. I mean, he is the news.
He is the news.
And then a lot of people have asked us about this, even though you've kind of already covered it. But I guess we've gotten an answer now as to whether Trump's tweets are a public forum and whether he can block people.
Yep.
And then finally, we're going to talk summer Zervos. It's summer's coming up and you got to get your Zervos. I don't know. No, summer Zervos is a person, apparently. And she is suing Donald Trump. So we'll have to see how that's going to pan out. Well, you had an announcement before we get going.
Yeah, I am really, really excited. We have coming up on Tuesday a couple of cases that folks are very excited for us to cover. The main segment is going to be Epic Systems Corp versus Lewis. That is the recent 5-4 Gorsuch decision right on class action waivers in the employment context. So we're going to do a deep dive on that on Tuesday. We are also going to talk about the NFL's policy that just came down and... There's no better expert for us to go to than friend of the show, Chris Christofko. And so we're going to have him on. We're going to do a segment on the NFL's new policy. We're going to hopefully give you some interesting aspects beyond just, boy, it sure looks like everything Chris Cluey said about how Jerry Jones runs the NFL and it's totally in Trump's pocket. That all seems 100% correct, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, I don't even want to watch the NFL anymore. Well, we'll talk about that Tuesday. We've got enough on our plates for one day, so we better get to it.
Yep.
Did the president approve of the payment that was made in October of 2016 by his longtime lawyer and advisor, Michael Cohen?
Evangelicals still believe in the commandment, thou shalt not have sex with a porn star.
This case has already been won in arbitration.
However, whether this president violated that commandment or not is totally irrelevant to our support of him.
Start me with So what's going on with Stormy and Avenatti in his Pro Hoc Vice motion? It sounds like there might be an issue.
Yeah, so here's the status, right? So we discussed the opposition to Michael Avenatti's motion to be admitted pro hoc vice in the Southern District of New York, right? This was filed by Michael Cohen's lawyers. They were really, really good lawyers. And so we went through Avenatti's response to the opposition to his motion for pro hoc vice to be admitted, and basically concluded that from the case cited in that brief, sure looked like Avenatti was going to be admitted in the Southern District, that, you know, just simply being out there and having access to the SAR and leaking the SAR didn't seem like that was going to exclude him, because among other things, the case he cited showed that there was no third party duty to keep SARs confidential. And that was really kind of the gravamen of Cohen's opposition. Since then, big news broke a couple of days ago that Avenatti, this is from the LA Times, for example, so, you know, your home state paper of record, I think,
right,
says law firm of Stormy Daniels attorney hit with $10 million judgment. So what's that, and is it going to affect his pending pro hoc vice motion? And it turns out this, as I started to research it, this is a weirder case than I expected. So here's what happened. In 2017, a private investigator named Gerald Tobin filed an involuntary petition for bankruptcy against Michael Avenatti's law firm, Egan Avenatti. That's a really weird, strange thing to do.
I don't even know what that is. Can I file that for someone? Can I just... I'm making you go bankrupt?
Yeah, you can. If you are a creditor and somebody owes you money and you file an affidavit and a complaint with the local bankruptcy court that says, hey, these people owe me money and they're not regularly paying their bills, but they're still in operation, the bankruptcy court can say, yeah, seems like we should take jurisdiction over this, because the whole point of bankruptcy is when a company's liabilities exceed its assets, you want to develop a fairness priority, right? Like, you want to stop the first in, first out, and you want to make sure that everybody who is similarly situated all gets paid in roughly the same basis, right?
So I think to break down what you're saying, it's something like, I declare bankruptcy.
That is exactly what it's like. And look, the reason to let somebody else declare bankruptcy on you is so that you, so suppose, right, Opening Arguments Media LLC, we take on a bunch of venture capital. We owe a lot of people millions of dollars. We know we don't have millions of dollars because
we're going to launch our own cryptocurrency. We're going to do a bunch of weird stuff.
We are. So keep sending us money. And so we decide that we're going to loot out the money from Opening Arguments, right? And so we start preferentially paying the vendors that we like, you know, like Brian, and we're not paying anybody else. And so...
Yeah, campquest.org, just all the ones, all our favorites.
Exactly, right. We're paying them preferentially. And so that's why the law permits a creditor to file an involuntary bankruptcy. So that's what this guy did, this guy Gerald Tobin. He was owed $28,700. Okay, so keep that one in mind.
You're laughing, and I think it's because for, you know, like a law firm, that shouldn't be a lot of money, right?
Correct. And I'm also laughing because once the bankruptcy was instituted, I'm going to upload this. It will be in the show notes and linked on our webpage. Then... notice goes out and everybody who's a creditor, right, has to file their claim, right? So Tobin initiates this bankruptcy over 28 grand. The bankruptcy court assumes jurisdiction over the case, says, yep, we're going to have a Chapter 11 liquidation, and everybody who's a creditor has to file.
There wasn't a step where they're like, here, I'll just open my wallet and pull out a few, you know.
So the answer to that is, I don't know, because it's not in the record, right? It's weird. You would think, right?
You would think so. You'd be like, here, I'll just cut you a check.
Right. I'll call up my friend Stormy Daniels. She's got a few extra $1,000s lying around.
Well, when did you say this was?
This was 2017. This was August of 2017.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm sorry. I take that back. This was March of 2017. So it was before Stormy was huge, but I believe he still represented her at this time. In any event, it's $28,700, right? Like I'm not trying to downplay that's not real money, but nevertheless, I would think that an established law firm could get a line of credit for $28,700,
yeah.
Right? You could borrow the money from the bank. But for whatever reason, and again, we don't know, not in the record, that didn't happen. And the law firm basically said, okay, fine, we'll let the court liquidate our assets. And then in that process, all of the creditors have to submit proofs of claim that identify them as creditors of Egan Avenatti, right? And saying that the law firm owes the money. And one of the people who filed a notice of claim is a lawyer named Jason Frank. And as a part of the bankruptcy, and again, this isn't in the record. I've had to piece this together from various sources. I think because the settlement was sealed and is confidential. I can't find it.
Wow. What do you got? Inside sources here? Is this breaking opening arguments news?
Private eye?
Like...
I wouldn't hype it that way, but I'm okay. Going to include the docket statement because you will see, right? I went on to the bankruptcy court for the Central District of California. That's where this case was adjudicated, and I pulled all of the filings, and it's not there. So anyway, Egan Avenatti agreed to pay this guy, Jason Frank, $4.85 million. Okay. And as part of the settlement, and this is coming from the LA Times reporting, this is something I do all the time with my clients, right? The payments were staggered, right? And as a part of that settlement agreement, right? So it said, okay, we're going to pay you $2 million on or before February 22nd, 2018. Then we're going to pay in continuing installments after that. And one of the things you often do as a lawyer, when you structure a settlement is you've compromised your client's rights if you're on the other side. And so you'll say, hey, look, we're going to let you pay over time, but if you don't make the payments in time, we have the right to accelerate the entire judgment or even the entire amount that we would have been owed if you don't pay us on time, right? And that latter appears to be the case here. So the settlement agreement appears to allow this guy, Jason Frank, that if he doesn't get his $2 million by May 22nd, 2018, to accelerate the entire $10 million in claims that he compromised. And that's what led to the headline that said, Avenatti has to pay $10 million, right? Law firm of Stormy Daniels attorney hit with $10 million judgment. So the bankruptcy court judge said, yep, this was a valid settlement. The condition of the settlement was that you pay the $4.85 million over time. You failed to make the first installment on time. Therefore, the law firm is liable for the entire $10 million. And
where do they get 10 from? I thought the whole time it was 4.85.
So think about it this way. And the immediate answer to your question is, we don't know because the settlement's not public.
Oh, okay.
Here's what but here's the supposition that I have, because this is very, very common practice. I sue you for $100,000. Okay. You and I agree to settle the case for $50,000 payable in 5 installments of $10,000 apiece, right? I say, I'm going to pay installment number 1 on or before May 22nd, 2018. And if I don't, then I consent to the entry of a judgment in the court for the entirety of the $100,000, right?
Wow.
So in other words, I can agree that, you know, and you can't characterize it as a penalty, but that's how you should think about it, right? That part of my inducement for you letting me pay you the 50 grand over time is, if I'm late, you can accelerate not just those payments, but everything to which you would have been entitled had we not agreed to the settlement. Make sense?
Yeah.
Yep. So that's what's happened here. Now, what does this say about Michael Avenatti? And the answer is, this is certainly not criminal behavior. And it is a breach of contract, if it is a breach of contract, which it appears to be. And contract law very explicitly has no moral connotation attached.
Right, you said that before.
Yeah, attached to when you breach a contract, right? So, you know, now it could be I want to put an asterisk on it, right? Like you, if I fraudulently induce you to enter into a contract, things like that,
right,
can invoke that. But, you know, if his answer was, yeah, sorry, we just had a cash crunch and we violated those terms of the agreement. And yep, we totally agree that we owe you the $10 million. There's no moral connotation attaches to that. So my evaluation is, I don't think this in any way is going to affect Avenatti's pending pro hoc vice motion.
Oh, okay.
That being said, I want to present the case for the other side, but let me kind of quickly say I've done some research and 98 to 99% of pro hoc vice motions are granted. The New York rule that we described last week says that a lawyer may be permitted to practice law in the jurisdiction. That's going to come up later, provided that they submit the affidavit that shows, and they have to show, number one, that they're in good standing. Number two, they haven't been convicted of a felony. Number three, they have not been censured, suspended, disbarred, or denied admission to any court. Or number four, they are not the subject of pending disciplinary proceedings. And Avenatti is not any of those things.
This seems weird. Like,
yeah,
this weird?
It does seem weird. And some folks wrote in after we initially discussed the Avenatti motion to point us to the Cliven Bundy case, right? And that talked about this. The district court up initially denied Cliven Bundy's request to have notable crazy person Larry Klayman represent him, and then the Ninth Circuit upheld that on appeal. And there are some surface similarities because, again, Larry Klayman is a publicly active crazy person. But I think it is worth pointing out the court in that case didn't say we're going to deny Klayman the opportunity to practice here pro hoc vice because we think he's a circus or a sideshow. Their reason, actually, and I'm going to read from the decision here, is that he, quote, was not candid with the court about the status of pending ethical proceedings. He disclosed that he was twice barred in perpetuity from appearing pro hoc vice before judges in the Central District of California and the Southern District of New York, but failed to list numerous cases, all of which are available on Westlaw or Lexis, in which he has been reprimanded, denied pro hoc vice status, or otherwise sanctioned for violating various local rules. And he has a record of going after judges personally. And shortly after Chief Judge Gloria Navarro denied his application, Bundy filed a frivolous Bivens action against her in her own court.
A Bivens action? Yeah. That sounds cool. I don't think we've ever talked about Bivens actions.
So we're going to have to talk about a Bivens action on another episode, but keep that on the whiteboard. And those of you who are our lawyers and law student fans, keep hounding us on Twitter to say, what about Bivens? We want more Bivens.
Yeah, chamber your Bivens actions, everybody.
Exactly. So, okay, so that seems a bit distinguishable, right?
Right. So you're saying when that person was denied the pro hoc vice, he's a mess. He's just an absolute disaster.
The closest case I could find to Michael Avenatti, right? Because if you're Cohen's lawyers, your argument is kind of this seems like a bad guy, right? Like he's okay. He's leaked this SAR report. Maybe he didn't have to, or maybe he didn't have to keep it confidential. But again, that seems like it's skating the line. And now, you know, he's got a firm that's reneged on its agreement to settle claims in bankruptcy. And again, you know, if he's not abiding by the highest ethical standards, maybe we don't want him in this district. And so I set out to research whether courts can do that, right? And here's what I came up with, right? So I came up with actually denying motions pro hoc vice is far more common than I thought, but not for the reasons that any of us expected. And it's for this. One of the it's not an issue in this case because we're just talking about being admitted to a federal court. But one of the things that states will do is they will specify in their pro hac vice application that you may not be a routine practitioner in the district, right? You may not have, and typically the language that's used in the model statutes is numerous or frequent contacts with the district. And the reason for that is really economic, right? It is, if I'm being admitted a dozen times a year to practice law in California, eventually the state of California is going to say, well, Mr. Torres, you seem like you're a California lawyer, right? Let's get you admitted to the California bar. Let's have you paying California bar dues to the state of California, right? Like, let's get you in California. Almost all of the denials of pro hac vice that I have been able to find on record are in the context of lawyers who are too frequently practicing in a jurisdiction, right? So That's where this comes up. Now, that being said, there are fun examples of lawyers who have been denied motions to appear pro hac vice that are akin to Larry Klayman. And the closest case, right? So if Cohen's lawyers are listening, I'm about to give them some free legal leads for their next memo.
Ooh. That's how we'll test if they're listening.
I suspect this will show up, even though this is a pretty distinguishable case, as you'll see. But the case is called Kollmeyer versus Amtrak. And it is a case from the District of New Jersey, Federal District of New Jersey from 2000. And it involved a Pennsylvania lawyer named Marvin Barish. And so the question that the court resolved is whether an attorney, Mr. Barish, who was in good standing of the Bar of Pennsylvania, must be admitted pro hoc in the U.S. District Court in New Jersey. And here I'm going to quote again from the decision, where his past behavior has been uncivilized and unprofessional and has resulted in reprimands, mistrials, and wasted judicial time. So the distinction here is, unlike Larry Klayman, there was a one kind of prior reprimand, but you know, he'd never been disbarred. He didn't have pending disciplinary actions against him, right? This guy was just, as far as anyone could tell, a complete and total jerk. And the court said, we don't want to admit this guy because he seems like he's a jerk. So let me explain what being a jerk meant here. It appears to the court that Mr. Barish's antics have not subsided. And this is coming after describing previous trials that had resulted in mistrial because he engaged in inappropriate closing arguments, all kinds of fun stuff, right?
Recently, you could do pretty much whatever you wanted to in those closing arguments.
Recently, limits, huh? Mr. Barish was involved in yet another case resulting in a mistrial. In this case, the mistrial was granted because Mr. Barish threatened to kill opposing counsel.
Okay, you can't do that. Okay, got it.
Mr. Barish later
admitted
to calling his adversary, that is opposing counsel, a fat pig four times in that same outburst.
Yeah, two is okay, but you can't do four.
Mr. Barish admits that his conduct in trying the case was, quote, volatile at times, but blames opposing counsel for taunting him, forcing him to behave in an ill manner. I could continue to go and then delightfully, you know, answering the reason I passed over your question is because Mr. Barish made the same argument that you just did, which was, Judge, I never knew saying something in a closing speech was worthy of my not being able to practice in this court. And to which the court said, well, if Mr. Barish chooses to act in an uncivilized, possibly unethical manner, he should expect negative repercussions such as this. So ultimately, the court denied Barish's pro hoc vice application, even though he didn't. I mean, you heard that language, right? Possibly unethical. They were convinced that, you know, he was running around threatening to kill opposing counsel and calling him a fat pig. But they were not convinced that he had violated the law or the canons of ethics in a provable fashion. And nevertheless, the court has absolute discretion, really, to decide whether to admit a lawyer. And that goes back to, and the reason for that, remember I quoted the language, may be permitted from the statute. That's different than must be permitted, right? That means the court gets to decide. And that decision, because it rests with the discretion of the trial court judge, can only be overturned if it is clearly erroneous. So I suspect that the application will be granted, but
yeah, well, you're saying if their best case is this guy you just described, I don't even see how that's a good case at all.
Well, because it says you can decline to admit a lawyer pro hoc, even if they meet the requirements of the rule in the court's discretion. Right. In the court's discretion to preserve decorum and to preserve the integrity of the process. That's the best argument you can make for keeping him out. The contrary argument is, of course, an argument that cuts across both, you know, the entire political spectrum. And that is, unless there are strongly compelling judicial reasons to the contrary, you ought to let a party be represented by the lawyer of their choosing.
Right? Yeah.
And I want to point out that the Ninth Circuit, the Larry Klayman case, and Larry Klayman is a crazy person with multiple pending proceedings against him and multiple prior censures. And I mean, yeah, like he's somebody you do not want in your courtroom. That drew a dissent, right? There was a dissent from the panel in the Ninth Circuit.
Hmm.
So, you know, it is a very, very strong principle to say, yeah, we let people be represented by the lawyers that they choose. And as long as it's not a farce, as long as, you know, they're in good standing, they know the law and they're going to know the law of the circuit and they're there supervised by a lawyer who is admitted to practice within it, then yeah, you ought to let them do it. So I think that's going to happen. We're not going to go through all the additional cases, even though they're fun. I will say, if the application is denied, Avenatti is going to be on the other side, right? Like it, the fact that it is strongly within the court's discretion means if the court uses its discretion to say, no, you're not going to be admitted pro hoc in this case, then there's very little possibility that he's going to get relief on appeal. And the case that helps establish that is a 1979 case called Lais versus Flint. That is the same Larry Flint from The People versus Larry Flint, ex-publisher of Hustler magazine. Turns out he's made a lot of constitutional law. and he is also responsible for the Supreme Court's rule that says, since the founding of the Republic, the licensing and regulation of lawyers has been left exclusively to the states, and a state can decline to admit a lawyer pro hoc for a good reason, a bad reason, or no reason whatsoever. You have no 14th Amendment right to claim that you need due process in accordance with being admitted pro hoc vice. So wow, we're going to keep our eye on that. It's a little bit weird to me that the court hasn't ruled on the motion yet. So, you know, if you want a red flag or a pink flag or a, you know, white flag that's been washed with, you know, the red shirt in the dryer, right? Then that's something that seems a little odd, but ultimately at the end of the day, I think he's going to be admitted, and I don't think there's anything that anybody's going to do about it.
All right. Weird. Kind of weird stuff, but thanks for the breakdown, and we'll get on to our next topic.
I think I am very restrained, and I talk about important things.
I'm going to do very restrained if I use it at all. I'm going to do very restrained. I find it tremendous. It's a modern form of communication. There should be nothing you should be ashamed of. It's where it's at.
So Andrew, this is a Andrew was right segment, correct? I mean, you called this one, I'm pretty sure.
It is indeed an Andrew was right segment, which is why we're doing it as the B segment, right? The main point of the show is for me to take a victory lap.
There's there's not even any content to this segment. It's just Andrew marveling in his own rightness.
Yeah, put in like the sound of like crowds cheering. You're like,
yeah, Chariots of Fire or something.
Go, yeah, way to go! You're brilliant. Yeah, right. So we covered this lawsuit when it was filed. This was back in OA77, which was the A segment to a really fun show, which we did with Carrie Poppy of the popular podcast Ono, Ross and Carrie, and a lifetime personal friend of Thomas's. So really, really cool.
Well, yeah, post-college lifetime, but yeah.
Yeah, that's a lifetime now, life buddy.
Friend. Yeah.
And their lawyer, Matthew Strugar. It was super interesting. In the A segment, we covered the argument, and I gave my opinion, which was I thought that it was a very, very interesting argument, and that I went into it sort of skeptical with the, oh, are Trump's tweets going to be a public forum? That seems like it could be fake news. You know, is it, you know, not well substantiated? And I came away persuaded that there was a decent argument. So go back and listen to that show, because the Southern District has ruled in this case that, in fact, Donald Trump's use of Twitter is a limited purpose public forum. And I want to break down a couple of things about the case, because I think it's really, really interesting. Obviously, going to link the order in the show notes. We learn some very interesting things about the White House from this order, because what the parties did here, it's a typical but not common practice. They agreed to a certain stipulation of facts for purposes of adjudicating the legal issues, right? So in other words, in order to expeditiously resolve the question, the Donald Trump's lawyers agreed to certain facts about how he uses Twitter. This is set forth on pages 10 to 11 of the opinion, but it includes something I didn't know, which maybe you knew this, Thomas, but since the president's inauguration, the @RealDonaldTrump account has been operated with the assistance of Daniel Scavino, the White House social media director and assistant to the president. With the assistance of Mr. Scavino, in certain instances, President Trump uses @RealDonaldTrump, often multiple times a day, to announce, describe, and defend his policies, to promote his administration's legislative agenda, to announce official decisions, to engage with foreign political leaders, to publicize state visits, to challenge media organizations whose coverage of his administration he believes to be unfair, and for other statements, including on occasion statements unrelated to official government business.
And to tweet out totally misleading videos of like ISIS murdering people that doesn't, anyway, stuff like that too.
Yep. That's what the president's lawyers signed off on, right? So they agree that that is a correct description of Donald Trump's Twitter account. I did not know Daniel Scavino has access to it.
Well, I had just read, and I don't know if it's from this, but I read a headline that was, or something that was talking about how this person also purposefully misspells stuff and like uses grammar errors because it makes it more like Donald Trump. And also it triggers the libs. And I think they love that. So I had just read that. I don't know. Maybe that's related too.
Yeah, he has access to the account, and he has the authority to post of his own initiative, right? So there are Scavino tweets that go out with Donald Trump's name on it. Typical public policy by politicians on both sides of the aisle is that you recognize that a celebrity's Twitter account, that a public figure's Twitter account may have somebody else operating it. And so, you know, you would use initials as a sign off to indicate a tweet actually written by the person, him or herself, right? Both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton did this. But Donald Trump likes that ambiguity, I guess, of, you know, who knows? Could be me, could be Daniel Scavino. Sarah Huckabee Sanders does not have access to the account. So the White House press secretary does not have access to the account. I cannot find a statement in the complaint, in the stipulation of facts, that specifies that no one other than Scavino has access to the account. It's the impression that the court gives, but I can't find any formal statement that says, no, it's just Don and Dan. But that's the impression that they give. Okay, so we learn a little bit about how Trump's tweets get composed. We learn about what he admits that he's doing with these tweets. The threshold question is Twitter a limited purpose public forum? Again, we go through this in great detail, defining what a limited purpose public forum is in episode 77. Not going to repeat that here. What I am going to talk about is the arguments that are being raised to the contrary, because I've seen even folks on the left who have said, I don't think this decision is going to hold up. And I don't agree with that. I think this decision is defensible. Look, I wouldn't have been surprised to see it come out the other way, but I don't think that it is going to get reversed on appeal for a number of reasons and for a number of cases, right? So the first is the arguments that are being raised by the kind of knee-jerk other side saying that this case is indefensible are, in my view, not well-founded, right? So they start off with, well, you know, it's Twitter, right? The government doesn't run Twitter. Twitter's a private company. So, you know, it can't be a public forum. That's not a great argument. It's not a great argument for two reasons. Number one, because there's no specific requirement that the government run something for it to be a limited purpose public forum. And the prior case law explicitly sets aside that public fora can be intangible, right? And number two, there's a fair amount of case precedent, and I think it's not hard to understand that when the government runs a website, right, that's a public forum, right? So imagine this case, right? Take the exact same facts. Instead of Twitter, the Trump administration runs a blog, right? And the blog is, we want to hear from real American citizens what they think of the president's policies. And then they go through and ruthlessly censor out everybody who's critical of Donald Trump. I don't think we would have any difficulty concluding, in light of this case, that that's a public forum. And the only difference is, instead of communicating out on Twitter and with the, you know, kind of how Twitter handles threaded comments and this and that, instead it would be, right, assume the blog is on WordPress, right, and it's hosted on Libsyn, right? Like it would still be the Twitter owns Twitter argument is the same argument as WordPress owns WordPress, right? Like when you publish a website, right, you don't technically own that website. It's hosted by somebody else. It's being published by somebody else, right? It's a third party for-profit company, but you've nevertheless created that forum. And I think that people who are saying, oh, well, you know, it's Twitter. Twitter is a private enterprise, right? It's not a public forum. I think that's too facile of an analysis. I also think that as we look at the case law, there are a couple of cases, right? The one that we discussed in episode 77 was a case involving Loudoun County. And what happened there was the county council in Loudoun County, Virginia, had a Facebook page, and they were censoring comments on the Facebook page. And the district court said, no, you can't do that. If you've set up a Facebook page as the official government and you're discriminating on the basis of content, right, you are engaged in a limited purpose public forum, and that provision of the First Amendment applies, right, that prevents you. So in a limited purpose public forum, you can exclude things that are unrelated to the purpose of the forum, but you cannot discriminate on the basis of content. You cannot discriminate on the basis of viewpoint.
So right? Then does that, well, I know, sorry if it's cutting to the end. So does that mean then if there's a Twitter user that's just posting dick pics on all
Trump's
things, is he able to block that?
He absolutely can block dick pics. Okay. The example that
we
used. What
if the dick pic is a political statement? Like there's something written on the dick. It's like, don't be a dick, Donald. I don't know, something like that.
And we discussed that on OA 77. The example that I gave back then was they could say we are censoring and removing all content that is profane, right? That would absolutely, in my view, survive scrutiny, even though that would probably have an ancillary effect on content, right? Because probably the people being profane at Donald Trump tend to be less approving of Donald Trump than his supporters, although I don't know that that's the case, having cycled through some Pepe the Froghead Donald Trump supporters. But suppose that it was, right? That kind of restriction is permissible in a limited public forum. But I think this larger argument of, well, it's Twitter, that can't be a public forum, that's not a great argument. And even if it gets all the way up to the Supreme Court, I don't think this will get up to the Supreme Court. No, it could. I look to a 2017 decision called Packingham versus North Carolina. This was an 8-0 decision, Okay. But there is a concurrence from the minority, which was Alito, Roberts, and Thomas. And this was before Neil Gorsuch was on the court. The Packingham case involved a North Carolina law, and that law made it a felony for anybody who was a registered sex offender, right? So out of jail on the sex offender registry, to, quote, access a commercial social networking website where the sex offender knows that the site permits minor children to become members or to create or to maintain personal web pages. So it would obviously include Facebook.
Right.
According to the sources cited to the court, North Carolina prosecuted over 1,000 people for violating that law, and then including the petitioner who was appealing that that law violates the First Amendment. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, that law is overbroad. That violates the First Amendment. That opinion was written by Anthony Kennedy, and I want to read his concluding paragraph and then talk about the concurrence. So Kennedy says, the proper analogy in this case, because they're, you know, again, going back and forth because this is 2017 and the Supreme Court is trying to figure out what Facebook is. The better analogy in this case is this Board of Airport Commissioners of Los Angeles versus Jews for Jesus, where the court struck down an ordinance prohibiting any, quote, First Amendment activities at Los Angeles International Airport because the ordinance covered all manner of protected non-disruptive behavior, including talking and reading or the wearing of campaign buttons or symbolic clothing. So, yeah, that was the Evangelical Christian Association Jews for Jesus complained that they were being censored from harassing people at the airport and giving away Chick Tracks and stuff like that. This is 1987 where, you know, you could walk onto the plane with a Gatling gun strapped to your side and people could just like wander through the airport and give you stuff. I know we come from a strange world, but
yeah.
So the Jews for Jesus sued, and as a result of that, the Supreme Court said, yeah, you can't prevent people from leafletting and giving out Chick Tracks at the LA airport. And then Kennedy says, if a law prohibiting all protected expression at a single airport is not constitutional, it follows with even greater force that the state may not enact this complete bar to the exercise of First Amendment rights on websites integral to the fabric of our modern society and culture. So that tells you where the majority was coming from in that case. And the Alito Roberts Thomas concurrence, as you might suspect, took issue with the somewhat expansive language of Anthony Kennedy there and said, the law is overbroad, so we are concurring in the judgment, but I cannot join the opinion of this court because of its undisciplined dicta. The court is unable to resist musings that seem to equate the entirety of the internet with public streets and parks, and this language is bound to be interpreted by some to mean that states are largely powerless to restrict even the most dangerous sexual predators from visiting any internet sites, including, for example, teenage dating sites, blah, 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 blah. So, but I will point out, even by adding, this was an 8-0 decision because this was during our period of limbo in which we had no ninth justice, even adding Neil Gorsuch onto that right-wing minority, we seem to have 5 votes for the expansive language of the majority that says we need to be
well,
thinking about...
Well, it doesn't even seem like you would need that, does it? I mean, for this.
No, you wouldn't, but I'm just trying to...
You're just saying it's over, like we're definitely... This is you making the case for that this should hold up even if it went to the Supreme Court.
That's exactly right. I am saying even if, because I could envision our listeners saying,
this
well,
is a belt
you told
and suspenders
us,
argument.
Exactly right. That's a proper use of belt and suspenders. Exactly right. Yeah. I could imagine our listeners saying, yeah, but you know, there are a lot of political hacks on the Supreme Court. Are they going to overturn it to, you know, give their friend Donnie a benefit? And I don't think so. I don't think it would be consistent with the
dicta
from Packingham.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, this is such a minor thing.
It is.
I mean, blocking, you know,
right.
I could see it being like with a different set of facts, I could see the same question being pretty significant, but with Twitter, it's like, I don't, you know, I doubt the justices are going to violate the First Amendment or kind of rewrite how this has been ruled just to make it so he doesn't have he's able to block people on Twitter. It's such it's not very high stakes.
And the court specifically said that he can mute people on Twitter. Right? I mean,
well, then
so,
what is that even? Well, okay.
Yeah. All yeah. Right. Well, I mean, what it does is it
I guess
prevents
it, yeah,
people from seeing what he's tweeting out. Right. So
yeah, that's right. Okay.
I mean, it's why I think it's rightly decided, right? Like that.
Well,
is,
Andrew
that
was right. That's why you heard all the celebration. That's awesome. You totally called this one, even though it did seem like, oh, come on, you know, at first. Yeah. But yeah, no, that's really fascinating. There, you heard it here first months ago,
almost a year ago.
Wow. Geez, really? I'm getting old. I didn't even have a baby then. All right.
No dad jokes in that episode for Thomas. All right. I want to talk about today's sponsor, which is Simple Contacts. You guys know two things about me, right? You know, number one, that I wear glasses and contacts. And number two, that I'm unbelievably busy all the time. And so I know this happens to you, but it happens to me pretty much every couple of years, where I'm on that last pair of contacts that's been, you know, I wear 2 week disposables and, you know, I'll be stretching 3 weeks, a month, 5 weeks, whatever. I'm down to my very last one and my prescription is expired and it's the end of the year and I'm trying to get everything ordered and taken care of. And now I've got to figure out a way to schedule an entire new eye doctor's appointment just to get another box of contacts. So that's why I'm super excited whenever we get sponsored by Simple Contacts, because I think this is a really, really fantastic service. If you wear contacts and your prescription is expired, you can take a vision test. It's self-guided. It's online. It takes a couple of minutes and they charge you the grand total of $20 for it. And then when you're done the vision test, you can order the contacts that you needed. I don't know about you, my copay when I see my eye doctor is more than $20. So this is totally the most convenient thing that has ever happened to me in the area of eye care. I need to tell you, right? Like, don't take legal advice from a podcast. Here's the legal disclaimer. You still need to see an eye doctor in person, right? This is not meant to be a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam. But what they have is a test that was designed by doctors and licensed ophthalmologists. They make sure that your vision hasn't changed. And if it hasn't, you can order your contacts online. They ship in a couple of days. And they have absolutely every brand of contacts that that I can imagine. I wear a pretty obscure, like kind of crazy prescription. And they had it no problem. And I got my contacts in 5 days. So if you wear contacts, I think you should check them out. There are two ways you can do that. If you're a dinosaur like me, you can head on over to simplecontacts.com/OA. Or if you're using their app, which is really, really cool, you just enter the promo code OA at checkout. But either way, you'll get $30 off your first order. And given that their exam is cheap and their contact prices are really, really competitive, seems like a good deal to me. So again, what I want you to do is check out Simple Contacts. Head on over simplecontacts.com/OA or enter the code OA at checkout and give it a try.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
Nobody, so you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just
Russia
say yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse. Yeah, I know you have to get up and ask a question so important. Russia is a ruse.
Well, I'm not a crook.
Andrew, Summer Zervos. Who is that? What is a Summer Zervos? I don't know.
It's the summer of Zervos.
Zervos?
Well, this weekend is the unofficial start of summer, right? It's Memorial Day weekend. So what better way to kick off summer than, okay, all right. That's it. I'm out of summer related puns.
Dad jokes.
You and I are both equally at fault for dad jokes now.
So. True. Yeah, that's true. It's going to be just a dad joke vortex.
New podcast idea.
With our powers combined, we will ruin the entire show. No, go on. Tell us about Summer Zervos.
Okay. So Summer Zervos is a former contestant on The Apprentice. And right before the election, Summer Zervos alleged that Donald Trump engaged in sexual harassment, that he tried to force himself upon her sexually in 2007 in connection with the show. This came out at the same time as the Access Hollywood tape. And so, you know, it was kind of buried. It was not a big deal. Presently, Trump and his lawyers, including Mark Kasowitz, who is, as I have promised our fans on Twitter, I would say, a lying sack of crap, have argued that the court must stay the proceedings by Summer Zervos against Donald Trump while Donald Trump is the president. This argument is nonsense. It is ridiculous. And the district court denied, and Trump appealed that denial to a New York Court of Appeals and has now stated that he's going to appeal that denial all the way up to the New York Court of Appeals. That is the state Supreme Court.
But all of this is appealing and reappealing and all that is just on this one stupid question that we all know the answer to.
It absolutely.
Wow.
And
that's
here's
our legal
why.
System, folks. Right. The world needs more lawyers.
Yep. It is. And here's why, right? So the New York Court of Appeals is a cert court. They could decline to take the case. I doubt they will because it's a fairly notorious defendant, but they could. There is an argument, but the argument is deceptive in the extreme. And it's why I called Mark Kasowitz a lying sack of crap. So let me first lay the groundwork. It's only going to take about 30 seconds because this is a case we talked about last episode. We talk about it
fairly
frequently. Everybody,
time him. My over-under is about 4.5 minutes on that 30 seconds. Okay.
Everybody. All right. Starting now. The case is Clinton versus Jones, which is the 1997 Supreme Court decision. That allowed Paula Jones to go forward with her claims against Bill Clinton, her civil lawsuit against Bill Clinton, even though he was the sitting president. And that case involved two state law claims, two federal claims, including violation of rights under Section 1983. And one of them was a claim for defamation.
Hmm.
How about that for 30 seconds? So I think that's exactly 30
wow.
seconds.
Wow. All right.
Summer Zervos has the same claim pending right now. She has a defamation suit pending because when she raised her allegations of sexual harassment, Donald Trump said, she's a liar. She's lying. She's a liar. And Summer Zervos said, that's defamation because you are denying a very specific fact that I have raised. And so she sued the president for defamation. I would contrast that with my general opinion where I am calling Mark Kasowitz a lying sack of crap. And that's why I'm calling him a lying sack of crap. And he's totally welcome to sue us for defamation. He's going to lose. So here are the two things. So you would say, if Bill Clinton could be sued while in office for, among other things, defamation, it seems kind of weird to say Donald Trump cannot be sued while in office for defamation.
That matter? No, it doesn't matter. They'll say whatever the thing. You know, I was thinking about this the other day. Normally, because there's a lot of hypocrisy in politics. You know, that's a both sidesy things. There's hypocrisy. I can't believe the president's doing this. And then, you know, when it changes parties, it's like, no, that's fine. And I was thinking, though, like, typically, I feel like there's only one or two major doses of that per, I don't know, year of a presidency. Like, some politician will have to eat his words. You know, a couple times a year, maybe at most. With Trump, it's every single day. It doesn't seem to matter.
And before we get into it, as additional support for my statement regarding Mark Kasowitz, I will point out that when you pull up Mark Kasowitz's Twitter feed, his pinned tweet at the top, right, is Mark E. Kasowitz praised by Norman Eisen, former White House ethics czar. Right. And Norm Eisen, somebody we've talked about, he is with the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, CREW, the outfit that has brought the emoluments lawsuit against Donald Trump. Right. So Tribe Eisen Painter. Right. He's Eisen. Right. He's also a former partner of mine from Zuckerman Spader. So he's a well-known ethics guy. So you would think, OK, well, I get it. Why you want, you know, well-known ethics guy on the left praises you. When you click on that tweet, it goes to a 404 page. So I did some more research. I found, I think, the Politico article to which it refers. And here's what Norm Eisen actually had to say about Mark Kasowitz. This was in connection with the notice that Kasowitz would be withdrawing or substantially scaling down his involvement with the Mueller investigation. Eisen says, "Finally, as for Mark Kasowitz, who is reducing his role in the investigation, he's a great lawyer who was pressed by his client into a DC role that he didn't want. Kasowitz served his client well by lining up counsel with the right experience," that referring to Dowd and Ty Cobb, "and he's stepping back now because that's what his client's needs dictate. He's a much different person than the caricature of him that emerges from recent press accounts. Given the president's dangerous predilections, Kasowitz and his firm are better off at some remove from him," meaning Donald Trump. I don't know. I would hope that if Norm Eisen were asked about me, that his quote praise would be slightly more fulsome than
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing to brag about.
Yeah. Norm Eisen says, "I'm probably not as bad as some people think." that's an interesting thing to brag about. And, you know, we could speculate all the reasons why you haven't removed the pin on your tweet, but you have removed the article to which the pin on your tweet refers. Anyway, so what are the two things that Kasowitz has said about the Summer Zervos lawsuit? He said, first, the Zervos case raises what the United States Supreme Court has called an important and unresolved constitutional issue, whether the Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution bars a state court lawsuit against the president during his or her term in office. Respectfully, the division's order denying a stay of the case pending the resolution of this key issue is incorrect. Now, that is technically correct, and unlike Futurama, it is not the best kind of correct in this situation. It is technically correct by parsing the very, very specific words here that Mark Kasowitz knows nobody reading this article intends to parse the words on, right? The difference between Clinton v. Jones and the Summer Zervos lawsuit is that Paula Jones brought her lawsuit in federal court, because in addition to her two state court claims, she also had a Section 1983 and Section 1985 civil rights claims. So the federal court can exercise pendant jurisdiction over the state law claims. Because it was a federal court, the Supreme Court, because as we have talked about since episode one, the Supreme Court does not render advisory opinions, right? They resolve live cases or controversies that are before them. So the Supreme Court gives this caveat, and you tell me how well you think this matches up with what Mark Kasowitz has said. Because the claim of immunity is asserted in a federal court and relies heavily on the doctrine of separation of powers that restrains each of the three branches of the federal government from encroaching on the domain of the other two, it is not necessary to consider or decide whether a comparable claim might succeed in a state tribunal. If this case were being heard in a state forum, instead of advancing a separation of powers argument, petitioner would presumably rely on federalism and comity concerns, as well as the interest in protecting federal officials from possible local prejudice that underlies the authority to remove certain cases brought against federal officers from a state to a federal court. Whether those concerns would present a more compelling case for immunity is a question that is not before us. That's it. I can tell you the standards that are articulated there, right? So the court is saying you don't have separation of powers of the three branches of government. Instead, what you have is the federal government vis-a-vis the state government, right? Those concerns are, if anything, stronger policy concerns than separation of powers, right? Like, we just did a case last week, the Chris Christie NCAA anti-sports gaming on the anti-commandeering doctrine that illustrates one of these facets, right? So the idea that the Supreme Court said, yes, we haven't resolved it in this case because this court was this case was in federal court and not in state court is true. The idea that the word important appears in that paragraph is also true. But to characterize that as the Supreme Court saying there is an important and unresolved constitutional issue is, in my view, highly, highly misleading. I think there is no doubt even this Supreme Court would immediately conclude, if called upon to resolve the question, that the fact that this arises in state court has no bearing on the underlying question. Because the underlying question is the president immune?
Can you sue the president, right?
Right, yeah. And all of the analysis remains the same. The implication remains the same, right? Because Bill Clinton had to answer Paula Jones' state defamation claims. So that distinction is, in my view, you could make it in a brief without being censured for it, right? One of the things that, you know, is commonplace language among lawyers is the phrase distinction without a difference. And I think that is the definition of distinction without a difference here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kasowitz's second claim is, it is also completely and unjustifiably contrary to the stays the courts uniformly granted when deciding whether a lawsuit against President Clinton could proceed in federal court. So, two things with respect to that. Number one, to immediately follow that statement with a reference to Clinton v. Jones illustrates the deliberate fraudulent intent that went into the making of that statement, right? And again, I'm using fraud in the colloquial, not the professional term. And number two, that statement is laughable, right? Yes, many of the courts issued stays of the Clinton v. Jones litigation, but that's because that was before the Supreme Court told them that they had to.
Oh.
And since then, you know what federal district courts don't do is disregard what the Supreme Court tells them to do, right?
Right.
So notice how carefully he parses that, right? He doesn't say, right, the Supreme Court said, he says, that it is contrary to the stays the courts uniformly granted, which referred to the district courts from 1992 to 1996. The Supreme Court decision was 1997, and no courts subsequently issued stays because the Supreme Court made it perfectly clear.
Wow, so, that is very deceptive.
Totally misleading. So
in other words, this guy is kind of a lying sack of crap. Is that what
kind of a lying sack of crap, exactly.
All right. Well, this is our only visit to Yodel Mountain this episode, and I just want to ask then, you know, we're up here on Yodel Mountain, we've cracked open a can of Summer Zervos, we've all got our Summer Zervoses in our hand, and what is this, are there any implications? I mean, this is going to go through the motions, and you're predicting, a firm prediction that this will hold up all through the court. So then what happens Yodel Mountain-wise?
So here's what happens Yodel Mountain-wise. When you have pending legal proceedings against the president, that's when the president can get in trouble, right? That's when you have to produce documents, sit for depositions, answer interrogatories. You have to make statements on the record. It is directly the cause of the impeachment of President Bill Clinton, right? Like the fact
that
he sat for
an interview. But all that would be related to this, what was it, sexual harassment
kind of thing? But if you don't think Summer Zervos' lawyers, I believe she's represented by, among others, Gloria Allred, if you don't think they're going to ask open-ended questions like, have you ever sexually harassed anyone, right? Like, they're going to ask these broad statements, and if Donald Trump issues, he will have two choices here. He can issue a summary denial, which will then wind up being perjury in the same way that Bill Clinton's answer was perjury, or he will be able to, give a nuanced answer, which will then be part of the public record.
Right. It'll depend on what the definition of is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. So it absolutely, will affect us in ways that we can't predict on Yodel Mountain.
I can't wait to do Summer Zervos is a legal genius. That'll be fun. Cool. Sure, well, thanks for the breakdown, and interesting. When do you think we would see some movement on this?
So the Trump administration is going to appeal to the New York Court of Appeals. That, because this is a purely legal question and there are no facts that are at issue, that could get resolved in a couple of months. So that's what I would be looking for.
All right. All right, there you have it. Thanks for the breakdown. We got a brief visit to Yodel Mountain. Nothing too heavy. I think there's some stuff developing kind of as we speak that we, you know, we're going to have to wait on in terms of Yodel Mountain. So we'll see if next week is another full slate of Yodel goodness.
Facts. I mean, I'm also following, but I have no legal analysis on the fact that close associates to both Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort have both flipped. So,
right. And then the rumor was like, no, he just flipped because, you know, he's fully just because to get his conscience. Did you hear that one? That he's like, no, it has nothing to do with Cohen. I wanted to get my conscience clean. And so who knows? I don't know.
If I spent a lot of time hanging around with Michael Cohen, I would want to get my conscience clean as well. So,
all right. Well, of course, we are keeping an eye on that. But now we've got to get to our co-favorite segment of the week, and that is thanking our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats, over on patreon.com/law. But first, we need to announce that it is already monthly Patreon bonus time with a Q&A with Lot Awful Movies. And guys, pay attention, because this is not just patrons. We changed it so that everybody can come watch the Q&A, the live Q&A. Now, again, patrons are the only ones who get to ask the questions for this, because I think it is important to maintain this as a benefit to our supporters. But we wanted to open up the live video for everybody. So this is going to be next Wednesday, the 30th, at 3:30 Pacific, 6:30 Eastern. That's when the live Q&A will happen. You will see us share the link on social media, on Patreon, of course. But for non-patrons, you also are invited. You can find the link by, you know, following us on all the places. So I'm really excited about that. It's fun to have that audience and that. And you'll get to chat and you know, who knows? Maybe we'll sneak in some chat questions here and there. But we also do the Patreon question thread so that our patrons are definitely prioritized in terms of the question asking. But okay, so I'm looking forward to that. And then Lot Awful Movies will be very soon. We're coordinating to see which guest we can get for that. And we'll announce that when we can.
Yeah, I am really excited. We are going to put up. So if you are a patron, head on over to patreon.com/law. There will be a thread where you can ask the questions to be asked at the Q&A, and you can use the little heart icon to upvote the questions you most want to hear answered. And we're freewheeling in that. So if you've ever had, you know, you've wanted to know the names of all of Thomas's cats, you wanted to know, you know, exactly how many hundreds of cats he keeps in his attic.
Everyone is just dying. They're like, oh, I didn't know we could ask that. And they just go, everybody's asking.
Yep. Yeah, that's what you can do. It's this is our benefit to you. So so head on over to that thread, ask those questions, vote for your favorites.
All right, well, it's time to thank our Hall of Famers. Go ahead, Andrew.
All right, so thank you to I, P. Andrew Torres, hereby renounce my license to use semicolons. Oh, gosh, boy, that hurts. To wordorigins.org, your guide to 13th century Saxon legal terms. To Anonymous. To Andrew, I need bail money. Yeah, you and me both, brother. To You're Never Alone with a Rubber Duck, and I hope that is a Beast Wars Megatron reference. So, to Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium. Thanks, Jeremiah. The prototypical San Jose shark, Timu Rijivari.
Oh, so someone, the person who pledged that, let me know that he was a first overall pick that never played for the Sharks or something like that. Like, they drafted him, but this is way before my time, you know, so I didn't know that reference, but yeah.
Big bust. Big bust. Yeah,
a big draft bust.
Yes. Growing up as an Orioles fan, our equivalent of that would be Drungo Hazewood. So,
oh, but that's such a good name. Didn't that person get to Drungo? Yep. Why Drungo? Why you gotta do it like that, Drungo?
Thank you. Drungo. This Week in News with Kevin and Benedict. To Don't Drown in Your Data Like the Terminator, go to alloyit.com. Yeah, there you go.
Nice. Plus,
Matthew Vernon, Heather Loveridge, Aaron Grady, Adam Lenda, Alec Emke. To That Moment When Your Patreon Name Doesn't Make Thomas or Andrew Laugh. Well, not now. To Hey, Matt and Rose, Become Patrons, You Cheapskates. Yeah, listen to them. To Brian Upshaw's Last Chance For-Profit Prison, Soggy Pants, Foxhole Atheist, the OA theme song sounds better at 1.5 speed. To Sam Danow, Eli Bosnick, Andrew Looks Nice in a Tie. Oh, well, thank you. Alton Brown superfan, Craig Jaskiewicz, www.clearprop.software, freelance iOS developer, to Yusuke Urameshi, Ian and Ally, Thomas Smith has a Bobson Dugnut rookie card, to our first patron of Thomas Takes the Rectal Exam, Dave Nichols, ooh, a little PG-13 here, Jim Grove, James English, to That's Just Like the Court's Opinion, Man. I love that. Usual Suspects. No, not Usual Suspects.
Wait, no, yeah, it's Big Lebowski.
Big Lebowski. Sorry, don't ask me why I confused those two.
Yeah,
both great movies.
Not even close. Yeah.
Nothing like each other, but both great movies. To Jordan Galash, to Triple Fried Egg Chili Chutney Sandwich. That's a Red Dwarf reference. Kevin Graham, Thomas's Second Chance Law Firm, survived Infinity War. Well, good to know someone did. I still haven't seen Infinity War, so no spoilers.
Yeah, no, actually, I intend to see it for Philosophers in Space, but I haven't yet either.
No. We should go together. Saul?
Let's do it. We'll meet halfway somewhere in,
Montana, or Missouri, I guess, is probably it. Anyway, Peasants with Pitchforks and Glow Sticks, and Malaika Chandler. Thank you all so much.
All right. So good. I love this segment. Thank you to Thomas's Cobblers, Exceedingly Poor. A String of Unpronounceable Characters. Bigglesby, Wigglesby, Jigglesby, Gigglesy, Flipperty, Flapperty, Yay. One of the other Latin canons of statutory interpretation. Impeachment in 26 weeks, Trump trial strategy of ineffective counsel.
Nice,
Lamb, the first purge. Time is an illusion, lunchtime doubly so. Squickfinger, campquest.org, campquest.org, campquest.org. Tricicular manslaughter. Buttercup's legal services can help protect against rabid lawyer dogs.
That's important.
Philip Stromberg, the Wayward Willis podcast. Occam's Chainsaw Massacre. Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. Our first patron, Danny Rosari. Reagan Klein, Rhonda the Dork. Roger, but the sign said all you can eat Metcalf, the frying Dutchman. Sammy, C6 Sarah. Trump run undone once, lump sum funds to dumb tongue C-Sun. Put Pete Rose in the Baseball Hall of Fame, and all the words are spelled slightly differently. So that doesn't translate to audio form, whoever did that, but maybe I'm not getting the joke. In loco parentis, King Leon, God of the Aboriginals. Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense. But lady, I'm flying a spaceship. Either Thomas or Andrew died at the end of Infinity War. Well, we know it's Andrew because my second chance life firm won. Beth can't think of anything particularly clever right now. Sakashite Fukusumi wants to live like gammon people. That's a very British. I actually get that one, Sakashite. You would be very proud of me. I actually get that one. Frederick Elstromer. Michael Ropps, director of the Opening Arguments Crisis Actor Department. Philosophical Zombie Demon. Stop Breaking the Law, Asshole. Liz is raising money for kids with cancer. Check profile link. Mitchell. Dave is tired of living in the dumbest timeline.
Yeah.
People said I was dumb, but I proved them. Donald Trump should switch to LegalZoom. And finally, Conrad Michaels. Oh, so fun. I love reading all those names. Keep up the good work. And thank you so much for your support.
Thank you.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right. It's time for TTT to GTBE. I had to use one of my lives to survive Infinity War, apparently. So I'm on one more chance. And so I'll probably get it wrong. No, I'm flying high after getting that question right. Man, that was... Whew, I'm retiring. Actually, I'm retiring. I'm done. I'll never do better than that one.
Do the George always leave on a high note?
Just leave the podcast. Just sit here in silence like Thomas.
All right. Here is your question. A state legislature passed a statute providing that juries in criminal trials were to consist of 6 jurors rather than 12, and that jury verdicts did not have to be unanimous, but could be based on 5 votes out of 6 jurors. A defendant was tried for murder. Over his objection, he was tried by a jury composed of 6 jurors. The jurors found him guilty by a vote of 5-1, and over the defendant's objection, the court entered a judgment of conviction, which was affirmed on appeal by the state's highest court. The defendant seeks to overturn his conviction in a habeas corpus proceeding in federal court, claiming that the trial court violated his constitutional rights by allowing both a non-unanimous jury verdict and a jury composed of fewer than 12 members. How is the federal court likely to rule in this action? It will set aside the conviction because the jury was composed of fewer than 12 members. B, it will set aside the conviction because the 6-person jury verdict was not unanimous. C, it will set aside the conviction both because the jury was comprised of fewer than 12 members because the 6-person jury verdict was not unanimous. Or D, it will uphold the conviction.
Oh my gosh, this is impossible. This is where I'm going to prove my ignorance of the 12 jury. So some amount of this stuff is in the Constitution and I don't know where, I guess. Or is it? Because if it's not, then D, I guess. I just don't have this knowledge. So this is going to be disappointing and hilarious. Prepare to laugh at my expense, everyone. Let's see. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a guess and say that I feel like the unanimous thing is flexible. Because I know there's those, we've talked about like 9 out of 12. We've talked about different numbers than unanimous. I feel like that part maybe will be okay. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that part will be okay. But I think maybe the 12 members isn't. And the reason I think that is for no reason. But other than I just feel like that's got to be in there somewhere. So I think I'm going to guess A. I hope it's D. That would be funny if all this is nonsense. It's like, yeah, no, it's totally fine. I'll eliminate B and D. And just figure A and C are my best bets. So I'm eliminating the 6-person part and eliminating the it will uphold the conviction. It could be D, though. I really don't know. So my final guess will be A because of the fewer than 12 members. And I'm just really guessing on this one.
All right. And so if you like to play along with TTTBE, do yourself a favor this week, right? Because Thomas has correctly analyzed the question, right? The question is, what does the Constitution require? See if you can answer it without Googling the relevant provision in the Constitution, right? And play along with us. You know how to do that. Just share, retweet out this episode on Twitter or Facebook. Include the hashtag TTTBE. Include your guess, your reasons therefore, and we will pick a winner and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune, not guaranteed.
All right. Well, yeah, this will be an opportunity for you to kick my butt on the question, everybody, and that'll be fun. So thanks for participating, as always. Thank you so much for listening. We're keeping an eye on all the Yodel Mountain goodness. Don't you worry. Don't you worry one bit. We'll see what happens next week. All right, that's our show. And until next we meet, keep breaking the law, everybody, so that Andrew has more business. See you then.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.